Hey, hey, it's your girl KV
and Celine,
and we are back with another episode of the Hood Health Report. Today we are going to talk about the history of HBCUs. This topic came about because I was like, what can we do for Black History Month to kind of, you know, shine some light on Black culture, Black history? And I was like, well, let's talk about HBCUs. So
I'm going to kick it off, and I'm just going to tell y'all a little bit about the background of HBCUs.
Who said that?
So the first article, A History of Historical Black Colleges and Universities. After the Civil War, which was from 1861 to 1865, HBCUs emerged to provide Black African Americans with the most basic human rights, which is access to education. Prior to the Civil War, the education of Black Americans was prohibited in most Southern states and was disencouraged in the Northern states, resulting in only a few Blacks being able to read, write, be able to do those types of things. Cheney, I wanna make sure I'm saying these correctly. Cheney University was established in 1837. The University of the District of Columbia was in 1851, Lincoln University, which was 1854, and Wilberforce University was 1856. Were some of like the starting colleges. Most of the nation's HBCUs were started by philanthropists. Most of the nation's HBCUs were founded by philanthropists and free Blacks. Southern states at the federal government and religious organizations such as AMA, which is the American Ministry Association, and the African Methodist Episcopal Church. HBCUs provided undergraduate training for 75% of all Black Americans holding a doctorate degree, and then 75% of all Blacks offered in the armed forces, and 8% of all Blacks that are federal judges at that time.
So I'm gonna get into some founding years for the HBCUs, but first I wanted to touch on the point that you said most HBCUs were founded by philanthropists. Mm-hmm. And I remember
the word I can barely say.
A few months ago, there was this TikTok, I guess, going around where like the person that did the TikTok was just so surprised that the founders of a lot of HBCUs were white. And they were like, did you guys know that this school was started by a white person and this school was started by a white person? And I was like, in my head, like, yeah. And not just because I went to an HBCU, but it's just kind of like, you got to think back to those times. Like, a lot of Black people didn't have the money to start a whole school. Mm-hmm. So it had to be, you know, a white person who believed in equal rights that went on to start a school. So, yeah, that was funny to me that a lot of people didn't realize that. Mm-hmm. My school, for instance, I graduated from Spelman. Like, it was literally started in a church basement by two white lesbian women. Like, they were like, these people need to know how to read and this not right. So they started off in the basement of a church and founded what is now known as Spelman College. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a lot of white people that, you know, helped us along in that regard. In 1837, as you mentioned, that's the nation's first and oldest HBCU, which is Cheney University, that was established in Pennsylvania. In 1854, the first degree-granting HBCU, Lincoln, was established in Pennsylvania. And it was interesting to me that the founding ones were in Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. but now most of the HBCUs are in the South. So in 1856, Wilberforce is the first Black-owned and operated HBCU, which was established in Ohio. In 1865, the first HBCU in the South, it was established in North Carolina, which is Shaw University. In 1890, the federal government granted land to black colleges and universities, so finally giving them the space to actually be a school. In 1965, HBCUs were officially designated by the U.S. Department of Education. In 2020, the first HBCU polo team was established at Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia. In 2020, the first HBCU cycling team was established at St. Augustine's at University of North Carolina. Also in 2020, the HBCU history course was established at Virginia State University. In 2020, the first National HBCU Research Center was established at Virginia Union University, and also, which isn't on here because I guess this was published before that, what school, dang, I just had it in my mind. There's a black gymnastics program.
Fisk.
Mm-hmm. So recently, Fisk University has the first gymnastics program at an HBCU. So, you know, there's still in this current day a lot of firsts that are happening at these black schools. So it's really good to see us, I hate to say it like this, but catching up to what other schools have, because a lot of people, you know, that's their reason for not going to an HBCU because, oh, well, I run track and they don't have track, or they don't have these sports, or they don't have gymnastics and I want to train with gymnastics and things. So it's good to see that HBCUs are catching up in that regard so that there is no excuse for people to not want to attend.
Yeah, and then what I also find interesting about the timeline is it's still current. Like, you know, we have some, like you said, so much catching up to do that it's going to be like a lot of firsts that continue to happen in the next years to come. And that's like exciting, you know, for us as a people too, to just be able to have some of those well-deserved equalities in education.
Yes. And this article also mentioned some notable HBCU graduates, such as Vice President Kamala Harris, who graduated from Howard University, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who graduated from Morehouse College, the first Black Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, who graduated from Lincoln and Howard Universities, and NFL Hall of Famer and TV host Michael Strahan, who graduated from Texas Southern University. Those are just some people that, you know, everybody would kind of be familiar with that have graduated from HBCUs.
And then I'm going to go a little bit deeper into some of the history about HBCUs. So it's known as HBCUs, but it's historically black colleges and universities. They were established in the United States in the early 19th century to provide undergraduate and graduate level opportunities to people of the African descent. In 1999, Washington and Lee University admitted John Chavis, who is noted as the first African-American on record to attend college, the first African-American to have earned a bachelor's degree from an American university was Alexander Twilight. He graduated from Middlebury College in 1823. Another person that I want to mention is Mary Jane Patterson. That was the first African-American woman to earn a bachelor's degree. She graduated from an abolitionist-centered college in 1862. Richard Humphreys established an African institute, is now known as Cheney University, in 1837 in Pennsylvania. And that made it the oldest HBCU in the United States. Its mission was to teach free African-American skills to gain employment. Students were taught reading, writing, and basic math alongside with religion and some of the industrial arts. During the 1850s, three more HBCUs were founded. It was Minor Normal School, which was founded in 1851. It was in Washington, D.C. The Lincoln University, which was founded in 1854 in Pennsylvania, and Wilberforce, which was in Ohio in 1856. The African Methodist Episcopal Church established Wilberforce University, and that was the first HBCU that was operated by African Americans, which is really important. The majority of HBCUs originated between 1856 and the 1900s, with the greatest number of HBCU started in 1867, 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. HBCUs are those IHEs established prior to the 1964 to educate persons of African descent. And I just want to break this down. So basically, in order for it to be classified as an HBCU, it had to be established before 1964. And they were founded as predominantly Black institutions, so PBIs, but included in the study as part of the 101 HBCUs. The technical definition of a PBI is an established for Higher Education Act in 2008, and it includes the following criteria. So this is what makes that criteria for it to be considered a predominantly Black institution. It has to have at least 40% of African-American students with a minimum of 1,000 undergraduates and have at least 50% low-income or first-generation degree-seeking undergraduate students and have a low but full-time undergraduate student in comparison to other institutions offering similar instruction. These qualifications reflect conditions in the HBCU's operative and indicate that since their sense of funding, HBCUs have continued to serve their core reason, and students who are African descent and are first generation or low income. It's approximately 89% of all HBCUs are in the southern region now, which you talked about a little bit earlier, how a lot of them were founded in the north. And the reason being is because back then, those were like the freer states. Like, it was easier for them to get funding to be able to fund those schools. And then now a lot of them are in the southern region because a lot more Black people are in the south. In addition, HBCUs have a diverse classification: public, private, liberal arts, land grant, independent university systems, single gender serving, research based, large and small, with enrollment numbers that can range from anywhere from 300 all the way over to 1,100,000 students. The U.S. Department of Education lists 4,298 degree-granting post-secondary institutions in the United States, according to the National Center of Education. And there are a total of 1,626 public colleges, 1,687 private nonprofit colleges, and then 985 for-profit colleges. And that was, last time I checked those numbers was 2017. HBCUs still only represent 2.3% of all total, of the total, with 101 institutions. And then the last thing I want to mention is that it's important to mention that HBCUs have also survived historical challenges such as Jim Crow, inadequate funding, deferred maintenance and accreditation issues, in addition to other issues and new circumstances that threaten the persistence of these institutions.
Yes, and it's important to understand why HBCUs were even created, because although there were some Black people going into these predominantly white, well, these white institutions at the time to get further education, a lot of Black people weren't allowed. A lot of colleges were not allowing Black people to come in and get education. So that's why HBCUs came to be, because if they weren't gonna allow us to come in, then we would just have to create our own. So that's what happened. We created our own.
And then the third article is just gonna go into a little bit more history, breaking down some of like how HBCUs were started in America. So it's called The History of HBCUs in America. In 1837, one-tenth of Richard Humphrey's estate totaling $10,000 was dedicated to the funding of the Institute of Colored Youth in Philadelphia. It was the very first institution of higher learning accessible for African Americans. In 1904, the school was relocated to a farm owned by George Cheney, some 40 miles outside of Philadelphia. Within a decade, it had taken that name, and it began granting degrees. Today, Cheney stands as the oldest African-American institute of higher learning and is still operating. More importantly, it was the first in a long, proud line of institutes that recognized the connection between education and equality. These institutions of higher learning have played a critical role in helping Black Americans dismantle the obstacles for freedom, equality, social mobility, and collective advancement. While Cheney University earns credit for being the first institute of opportunity for African Americans, it would not have the power to grant accredited degrees until the start of the 20th century. Lincoln University of Pennsylvania, also located in Pennsylvania, owns the distinction of being the first HBCU to issue degrees to its graduates. Lincoln was founded near the town of Oxford in 1854. It took its current name a decade later to honor America's recently assassinated president. Because it was the only institute in the United States that granted degrees to Black graduates, Lincoln attracted excellence throughout the United States. In particular, during the decades of segregation, many of the best and brightest young minds in the South fled the Jim Crow laws and found opportunity at Lincoln. Remarkably, in fact, from 1854 to 1954, 20% of all physicians, 10% of all Black attorneys had and earned a degree from Lincoln. And in 1972, Lincoln became affiliated directly with the state of Pennsylvania and transformed into a public institution. The oldest surviving private HBCU is Wilberforce University, Wilberforce, Ohio. It was founded in 1856. Wilberforce also stands apart as the very first institution of higher learning in America to be owned and operated by African Americans.
So today, HBCUs still provide an atmosphere in which Black people were safe to discuss their collective plight openly, to forge solutions, and to mass their efforts into a meaningful HBCUs still provide an atmosphere in which Black people are safe to discuss their collective plight openly, to forge solutions, and to mass their efforts into a meaningful path forward. With this, HBCUs attract some of the boldest and most ambitious future civil rights leaders, such as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who was accepted to Morehouse College his junior year and later graduated in 1948. In 1950, Sweet versus Painter became the first Supreme Court case that successfully challenged the notion of separate but equal. This was the result of a Black man that challenged the Texas state constitution, which denied him access to the school of law on the basis of his race. The Supreme Court found that there were stark differences in the quality of education available to white students and Black students. These cases set the stage for the 1954 decision in the Brown versus Board of Education, in which it was resolved that separate is inherently unequal. This decision was a critical turning point in American history and marked the beginning of the civil rights era. So in the late 1950s, HBCUs became a critical part of the movement toward total desegregation in the South. Florida A&M, North Carolina A&T, Tennessee State, Fisk, and Meharry all staged sit-in campaigns that led to further push for equal rights. HBCUs and their treatment were integral parts in events such as the 1963 March on Washington and the March from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama in 1965. These events led to the passage of the Voting Rights Act and the Higher Education Act of 1965, which increased the amount of federal resources dedicated to the colleges and universities while enhancing student access to financial assistance. In turn, the advancements of civil rights opened the doors of white colleges to Black students. This resulted in a drop of enrollment at HBCUs and a general shift in the educational landscape, which really, like, reading through it and, like, knowing how these things happen, you know, along the timeline of them trying to push HBCUs, it was like, dang, like, I get that we still want, you know, to be equal and we want to be allowed in these spaces, but this happening at the same time that we're trying to establish HBCUs and get people to go to HBCUs, it's like, might be a little bit counterproductive. And, you know, it was because they said it was a huge drop in HBCU enrollment because now we're forcing the white schools to allow us to go there. So that was one kind of
take.
Yeah, one take that really affected HBCU enrollment. So this caused HBCUs to begin to diversify their student body. A study by the University of Pennsylvania Graduate School of Education reported that in 1950, HBCUs were comprised of 100% black people, but in 1980, the number was closer to 80%. Therefore, HBCUs had begun to enroll Asian, Latino, and even white students. And it makes me think about just the schools. My husband laughed because I feel like you know what I'm going to say. I remember, I think it was my freshman year at Spelman, everybody was up in arms because not only was there a couple of white guys at Morehouse, but the valedictorian was a white guy. And everybody was like, what kind of mess is this? And but it's like, okay, if we're allowing them here, we can't hold them back just for the sake of we don't want a white person to be a valedictorian. I mean, you allow them in. You have to deal with what comes with that. And at Spelman in general, it would be so like we knew that other people would enroll, but when we saw, you know, Asian students on campus, we'd be like, when we get Asian sisters, y'all? Like, when did this happen? So it's still something that is interesting to see on campuses, even though we know that HBCUs will allow, you know.
Did you ever, like, ask? Have you ever asked anybody that wasn't black on campus, like, what made you choose?
Yeah.
Okay. That's me. I would want to know.
Because I would genuinely want to know, like, what made you want to come be around, you know, black people? Same. Now, I will say, with Spelman, a lot of our non-black students were domestic exchange or study abroad students. And they just wanted to see, you know, something different. They say a lot of them were like, we didn't even really know, as far as study abroad, we didn't even really know schools like this existed. So once we went through our study abroad, you know, brochures and programs, and we saw that, oh my goodness, there's a college just full of black women, like, I've got to see it. And they were just like, you know, excited to be in such a place. So it was very interesting to talk to those students because, you know, I like to get people's perspectives on But I don't think while I was there, we had anybody that was like officially enrolled as a Spelman student from start to finish that was non-black. But like I said, we definitely had a lot of domestic exchange, a lot of study abroad who were non-black. So in 1980, President Jimmy Carter signed an executive order calling for the distribution of greater federal funds to HBCUs. To this day, HBCUs still play an outsized role in helping to advance black students in their education and professional goals. Two of which, one being Xavier University of Louisiana, they only enroll 3,000 students annually, but it leads the nation in black graduates who go on to complete medical schools. And similarly, Spelman College, which holds the distinction of being the oldest private liberal arts HBCU for women, and it's my alma mater, they have been ranked number one HBCU for about 17 years and is among the top 50 colleges that produce Fulbright and Truman scholars. It is also the largest collegiate producer of black women with science, engineering, and math doctoral degrees, while only enrolling 2,000 students annually. Currently, HBCUs are still facing problems with endowments, closures, and enrollment numbers. So as HBCU grads and just people that care about HBCUs, we have to make sure that we give back to these institutions and encourage the younger generations to consider enrolling in these schools. That's all I got. You got some more?
No, I mean, I have like a question for you.
Okay.
Do you feel like it's important, because that little last part was like encouraging people to go to HBCUs, do you feel like you do like a good job of encouraging and like pushing for HBCUs?
I definitely will preach to any high school student to consider HBCUs, but I know there are a lot of obstacles with that. Like I mentioned earlier, the lack of sports teams or track teams and things of that nature. You know, it's a deterrent for people who've, you know,
yeah,
dominated their fields in certain sports, I know that they wouldn't want to necessarily compromise that by going to an HBCU that wouldn't allow it. And also, HBCUs are expensive. Mm-hmm. I know my HBCU is a private school, so it was very expensive to attend. So a lot of people, you know, they don't have the means to afford it, or they don't want to take out that much student loans to go to these schools because they didn't know ahead of time to, you know, rack up scholarships or apply for different scholarships. But I definitely preach to middle school, high school kids to consider HBCUs. And there are public HBCUs that wouldn't be as expensive. And I just think it's important that we go where we're applauded and not just allowed. I can recall having a friend who
That's a great
went
statement.
To... It is, right?
Yeah.
Because going to where you're allowed doesn't mean they want you there.
Yeah.
I can recall, what was that? Mizzou mm-hmm. University. They were like being so cruel to the black students some years ago. They were like hanging nooses and bananas on their doors and just being very racist.
The accident with the young man that died, was it Fred? No, I don't want to say the wrong name. But it was somebody that died in the area mm-hmm. in Missouri. And then after that, they just, yeah.
It got really crazy. And
that was around the time that I was going through school.
Uh-huh.
My first school, I won't name it.
Oh, I don't know what that was. Oh. I'm talking about when I was in school.
Oh, well, you know what I'm saying? When they've been doing like, they start back doing certain things mm-hmm. like that. And it's kind of like sad to say like that, yeah, what you said is true.
Yeah.
You should go places where you're not only accepted, but you're wanted.
Yeah.
In a sense.
It's very important. And I have some friends who are Mizzou graduates, and they will argue you down how, well, it's my right to go to what school I want to go to. And I'm like, yeah, but at what cost? Not saying that you made the wrong choice, but, you know, you had to be traumatized in your experience. Mm-hmm. Not everybody wants to deal with that. Mm-hmm. Me, for instance, I wouldn't want to have to deal with racist people, you know, knocking my food out of my hand or putting nooses on my door. That's just not something I want to deal with while I'm trying to work on getting an education. Mm-hmm. But some people, you know, it's not as big of a deal for them. Mm-hmm. So I don't down those people. I don't think that, you know, they're stupid or anything like that. It's just everybody has a choice. Mm-hmm. So whatever your choice is, but I do make sure that those middle schoolers I know, those high schoolers I know, that they know about HBCUs. And not that they have to go to any particular one, but definitely should consider mm-hmm. HBCUs in their colleges. Because, mm-hmm. like I said, it's important that we keep these schools open. Mm-hmm. A lot of these articles mention schools that had to be closed because there was no funding
yep.
or people stopped attending. And even in the Atlanta University Center where I attended, what's the name of that school? Morris Brown, Jesus Lord. And even in the Atlanta University Center where I attended, Morris Brown was not accredited for some
yeah.
years. So a lot of people, you know, didn't really want to go to a school that wasn't accredited because that's risky if you're trying to get into a graduate school or get certain jobs mm-hmm. that require your institution to be accredited. But now it does have its accreditation, and it is enrolling students again, you know, at the numbers that it should. So it's very important to make sure that we give to these institutions and we have our younger people attending these institutions so that they're still there, so that they're not forced to go to a predominantly white school because there are no options. So yeah, I definitely get on my soapbox about HBCUs for sure.
That school was American University, not Mizzou.
No, it was definitely Mizzou. It may have been another school that it happened to, but yeah, it was definitely Mizzou. I had very in-depth conversations with some of my Mizzou friends about that. But yeah, it did happen at multiple schools
yeah.
because like when it came to, when I was in school, I cannot think of, we did a lot of marches about you know, black men not being executed. I can't think of the specific names right now, but I can remember my freshman year how Spelman and Morehouse and Clark, we got together to do a huge march throughout Atlanta to, you know, protest these executions and things of that nature. And in response, that was, you know, what a lot of white students at predominantly white institutions were, you know, responding to, because the black students on campus would speak out about certain things and they'd be like, this is not the place for you to talk about your black issues. Take that elsewhere. Go take that to an HBCU. We don't want that here. And that was their response, was to kind of make those black students feel ostracized and unwanted. So, yeah, it definitely happened at quite a bit of schools throughout the years because, like I said, just because they're allowed doesn't mean they're wanted there. So, yeah. But that concludes this episode of Hood Health Report. Hope you guys enjoyed this conversation about the history of HBCUs, and we'll see you on the next episode.
So this is a wrap for this episode. I hope y'all enjoyed it. You can follow us on Instagram, which is Hood Health Report, as well as Facebook and Twitter, Hood Health Pod.
We also have a TikTok page now, Hood Health Report. Follow us there.
Yeah.
Don't forget to subscribe to the YouTube channel. All of the links will be in the descriptions and the bios for you to click on.
Tap, like, comment, do it all.
Subscribe, all of the things. Share it with a friend.
Yes.
Share it on your social media.
If you have a TikTok, make a little video, send it.
Let us know you're out there watching, guys. All right, that's it for this episode. Bye.